from Hollywood, CBS presents Raymond Massey as the Country Lawyer. The Columbia Broadcasting System presents a one-hour treatment of one of the great American biographies of the century, Country Lawyer, the portrait of a dignified, strongly individualistic, and lovable personality, such as could have been produced only by the country town as yet unimproved by the automobile, radio, and the chain store. It is at once a human document of a man and of a profession, a remarkably vivid picture of American village life from the mid-60s until just before the First World War. CBS takes pride in presenting one of the foremost stars of stage, screen, and radio, creator of the role of Abraham Lincoln in Robert Sherwood's unforgettable drama, Abe Lincoln in Illinois, Raymond Massey as the Country Lawyer.
Let's have order in the court, please. You may proceed with the case.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've heard a vast amount of testimony on behalf of my client, Samuel Selden Partridge, referred to in this case as the Country Lawyer. You've heard many witnesses give many reasons why your verdict should be most favorable. I have but 60 minutes, 1 hour, to present our case, to sum up those things you must know before arriving at your verdict. Let me begin by asking you to recall the testimony of the publisher's representative who, but a short time ago, from this stand, spoke of the sales of...
And unanimously decided to publish Country Lawyer. Its first edition appeared on the bookstand June 6, 1939. A second and third edition followed in but 5 weeks. Before 3 months had passed, it had been necessary to order its seventh edition.
Well, that was an excellent record. What happened then? Did sales drop off?
Oh, absolutely not. By the end of the year, Country Lawyer had passed 11 editions and had consistently been the bestseller of all nonfiction books throughout America. We were delighted.
At the same time that Country Lawyer was the biggest hit with readers of good books, a man named Raymond Massey was the biggest hit with followers of fine plays. Massey, as Abe Lincoln in the Robert Sherwood production, was giving a stirring interpretation. More than that, a living, breathing, startling reincarnation. And while book readers and theatergoers were praising these two highlights of drama, Hollywood was displaying its customary vision. 200,000 copies of Country Lawyer meant over 1 million readers. Over 1 million readers meant a sizable, enthusiastic nucleus of emotion for appreciation for all things American. From Europe was coming daily headline evidence that this nation was a pretty good place. And books like Country Lawyer were printed confirmation of that fact. The result of these facts and negotiations? Paramount Studios purchased for film dramatization the number one nonfiction seller, Country Lawyer. And further, I beg you to take account of the testimony offered you immediately following. The Columbia Network, you will recall, had been earnestly seeking a story property, which would represent not only a new type of radio entertainment, but also a significant view of America. Small-town America in the late 1800s. It found that property in Country Lawyer, and for the title role, engaged the services of the one actor ideally suited for the part, Raymond Massey. The forecast series was unquestionably the perfect medium for presenting the new radio idea. So scripts were prepared, time was reserved, and arrangements for broadcast were made. As the witness explained, the best-selling biography was transferred to the radio form, and the adaption went to the Columbia Sound Department, where it was given an advanced study in order to anticipate all possible sounds.
Hey, Dick, what's going on?
Just going through the script, Al, seeing what equipment we need.
No, I mean that effect. What in the world is it?
Old Ocean.
Old Ocean? You don't mean the ocean.
No, that's what they called their firefighting water pump. It was mounted on a wagon, sort of. Only one thing bothers me. How do you make a sound like a tandem bike?
Wilbur Hatch, CBS conductor, studied the music content of the script. Began his rehearsal.
Let's play our second cue now, the one that comes in under Massey's narration. All right. Oh, that sounds more like Boogie Woogie than an 1885 house band. Come on now, put a nice pair of button shoes on. Okay, once more.
There were, as you learn, further conferences on how best to present the sample half-hour drama to forecast listeners. And it was in the program.
You know what I think? I think the listeners would get a kick out of how Partridge's son came to write this book.
Just before they hear the drama, you mean?
Yeah.
Not a bad idea.
Well, look, suppose we do this. Suppose we put a guy on the witness stand who'll explain how Bellamy Partridge...
Oh, wait, I've got a better idea. We'll put Bellamy Partridge on the stand.
That's what I meant.
Here's what we'll do. We'll have Partridge start where he goes into his father's office to take over. You remember? And how when he's rearranging the furniture, moving his father's desk, he came across
it
that...
It was a heavy desk, and as I moved it, one of the end panels came loose and fell out on the floor. When I picked it up to replace it, I discovered that it was the removable door of a hidden compartment. I'd known that desk for over 20 years and had never known of that secret cubbyhole. But my father had. For inside, I found a bundle of old letters, a bottle of Piper Heidsieck champagne, and further at the back, woolly with dust, a small black notebook. I'd never seen it before. Nothing was written on the cover, but when I looked inside, the first entry I saw was... Strange and unusual cases encountered in my practice of law. I began reading, and as I turned the pages, something began to happen. A whole little upstate New York village began to come to life. It was the town of Phelps, reappearing as she had been in that serene half century of comparative peace between Appomattox and Sarajevo. Old friends rose slowly to greet me from those dust-covered leaves, friends I'd known as a child, and friends who'd passed on before I was born, those I'd only heard about. I could see the town as my father once described it, and it was almost as though he were there telling me of Main Street.
Lined on both sides by giant shade trees, elms and maples, the gnarled locust and the shedding chestnut. I could see the little cloud of dust raised by a passing horse and buggy. Hear the jingle of trace chains and the creak of harness leather. And presently, the clump of farmer's boots on the wooden planks of the sidewalk. There in the fork of the street, 100 paces to the left of the corner, stood a circular bandstand with a high-pointed roof topped by a flagstaff. On holidays, like the 4th of July, Old Glory would be up there. The band would be holding forth for all it was worth. About the only places open in town would be Jim Hoyt's blacksmith shop and the refreshment emporium next door to the Grange building. Art Robin's saloon, very fine for group singing. But those were special occasions. It was just an ordinary, run-of-the-mill, crisp October afternoon when I first saw Phelps. And even so, I liked its looks. I thought I'd find out about the prospects and decided to talk to one of the local lawyers. There was only one, Charlie Hobson his name was. I located his house, and when I knocked at the door, he opened it, but only a few inches. Peering out at me was a small, bandy-legged man in his 60s, with a wary, unfriendly look on his sharp face.
Yes? What do you want?
My name is Partridge, Mr. Hobson. I wonder if I could see you for a few moments.
What about?
Well, about some advice.
Legal advice?
Yes, in a way.
I'm busy. Come back some other time.
No, wait. I'm a lawyer, too, you see, and I wanted to talk to someone about moving here.
Well, why don't you say so? Come in, young man. Come in.
Thank you. I'm not sure you understand me, Mr. Hobson. You see, I'm considering going into practice here.
I heard you.
In other words, if I'm lucky, cutting into your field.
Excellent. Splendid.
You're pleased?
Best news I've heard in years. Lordy, they come down here at night and ask me to draw papers for them. They fire questions at me over the fence while I'm speeding. They poke at me through windows and clamber up into my buggy. How soon can you settle?
No, just a minute, sir. I haven't made up my mind. I'm only investigating.
Yes, of course. Well, let's see. Where are you from?
Rochester.
Married?
Yes.
Any progeny?
Soon.
Any money?
Some. By the way, I can believe that you're a regular demon in the courtroom.
Think so, huh? Young man, only about 1% of the legal work around here takes place in the courtroom. This ain't Rochester. This is the village of Phelps. Population just short of 5,000, according to the 1880 census. You'll use a notary public seal until you're blue in the face. You'll write deeds and draw wills, settle street brawls and threaten horse traders. Advise old man Hughes how to cure his backache and sympathize with old lady Lehman about the loss of her son, the Battle of Bull Run. And for what? Practically nothing. Terrible.
Then why have you put up with it for so long?
Well, you'll find out. No, Sam Partridge didn't make up his mind right then. One thing he did, though,
stayed there talking so long he missed the train back home. I tried to get him to stay with me, but he wouldn't have any part of it. So at his request, I recommended the Woodpecker Inn. That's the domain of old Tick, who weighs an even 250 pounds in his hot feet and has a very narrow eye for strangers. I heard what happened later. Now, we gave the young man in the frock coat and beaver top hat a thorough inspection as he entered the lobby. Stood for the desk. Old Tick, an expert marksman with chewing tobacco, took careful aim at the red-hot stove 6 yards from the desk and fired.
Good shot.
There. What can I do for you?
I find that I've missed the last train for Rochester, and I'd like to get accommodations for the night.
You live in Rochester?
Yes, I came here today to look over
Whereabouts
the town.
Whereabouts in Rochester?
On Ely Street.
Never heard of it. Ain't no such street there that I know of.
It's near Maine, up above Clinton.
Know all about Clinton and know all about Maine, but I ain't heard nothing about Ely.
I suppose I should have brought along some pictures of the street. Merely an oversight.
Now, hey, where's your baggage? Ain't you got no grip or nothing?
I haven't. You see, I didn't intend to stay here when I... Now, wait. I just explained all that. Can't we come to some kind of an agreement? I'm a reasonably respectable person. All I want is a place to sleep.
Well, all right. But it'll cost you half a dollar in advance.
It's a deal. Now, if you can trust me with that register and the pen... Thank you. Why don't you try biting it?
Don't need to. Can tell by bouncing it. S.S. Partridge. That's your name, is it?
That's right.
And you come from Rochester?
Ely Street, remember?
Here, what you looking at, young fella?
That thing on the wall. It's certainly the largest gong I've ever seen.
That there's what I signal with, and it ain't a gong, it's a cymbal. When you hear that, it'll be 6 a.m, you'll have an hour to make your train and get back to Rochester. If that's where you come from. Come on, I'll show you to your room.
When Sam Partridge heard the crash of that cymbal again, it was accompanied by the aroma of fresh, strong coffee, absolute darkness, and strangest of all, music. He put on his clothes and went downstairs to see what
kind of a town is this? Where's that racket coming from?
Across the street. Hook and Ladder Company's practicing for a minstrel show.
Is 6 a.m. the only time they can do it?
Who said it was 6? Look at the clock. It's midnight.
Midnight? Then why wake me up? Why did you beat that gong?
So they'd shut up, that's why.
Good heavens, what's that?
That's the Hose Brigade. They're next door practicing for a dance.
Why on earth did they practice at the same time?
Because they're rivals. They hate each other.
I don't blame them.
Hey, over there. Cut out that noise. You're disturbing my guest.
You're worse than they are.
He can't sleep, you hear? Stop that racket before I call the sheriff. Stop it, I say. Well, I got one of them anyhow. Guess we'd better have some coffee now.
I see you have an extra cup already placed.
Well, it gets kind of lonesome around here sometime. Have a seat.
Look here. That music didn't wake me up. It was that gong of yours.
Cream?
You did that on purpose.
You take sugar?
Yes, I'll take sugar and also my half dollar.
Sure. Now tell me, young feller, what do you think of Phelps? Well, sir, that was my first meeting with Sam Partridge. And as to what he decided about Phelps, all I can say is that the next morning he pulled out for Rochester. I guess that's where he really lived, all right. But 2 days later, he was back with his wife and a set of law books. He rented himself an office almost as fast as he bought a house. Pretty nice house, too, but kind of run down. Needed quite a lot of repair work. When he asked me if I knew a handyman around, I thought of Jerry Billen. I thought of him, all right, but I was a little worried about actually taking him over. Jerry didn't strike everybody in just the same way. By that, I mean I was practically the only person in town who could stand him. For a man of 50, Jerry had less and cared less than anybody I ever see. Just the same, I knew he needed the work, so I took a chance. When we got there, Mrs. Partridge, righty pretty little thing, too, was out in the yard working on a flower garden. When I introduced her to Jerry, she smiled, brushed the dirt off her hands.
How are you, Jerry?
All right. How's yourself?
Well, I'm fine. I understand you're interested in doing some work for us, Jerry.
All depends. What kind of work is it?
Nothing much, really. We need the fence painted and some new screens put up. And, of course, the well that's here now isn't so good. Oh, yes, and the cellar could be deepened and just odd jobs.
Be odd if one man could do all of them. How much are you paying?
I couldn't really say. Mr. Partridge will be here in a minute. You can take that up with him.
Yeah, if I take the job, you mean.
You crazy fool. You ain't got the sense of a goat. You ought to...
Tick, how dare you?
Huh? What did I do?
Why, you... You know what you did. You...
You mean he spit, ma'am?
Right on my new garden. He'll ruin it.
Why, heck, he will. That garden's already ruined.
Well, I suppose you know all about it.
Yeah, just about. First thing, you got it placed so as it'll be washed clean away the first heavy rain we get. The second thing, that soil there wouldn't grow a blade of grass. And next place...
Oh, hello, Tick. Let's see you.
Oh, Sam. Say, Sam, this here's Jerry Billings. He wants to see you about work.
Yeah, now hold on there, Tick. There are a couple of things I want to ask you first, mister. You got a good set of garden tools?
Fairly good. We expect to add to it.
Yeah, and what about a place to sleep? You got a tool shed or anything?
I suppose we could arrange accommodations.
Do you go to church?
Why, yes, we... Look here, are we hiring you or are you hiring us?
I'll take the job.
You? Well, that's awfully good of you. Just how much are your services worth?
Well, nothing, I guess. I'd kind of like to fix up this garden. Now, Miss Partridge, if you come over here, I'll show you...
It didn't take Sam and me long to discover that Jerry had a way with flowers that nobody else had. He was an artist. But it was some little time before we understood Jerry's interest in our religious habits. For 6 weeks in a row, he went with us to the Presbyterian church, and then suddenly, he stopped. And it wasn't until I was talking one day to Mrs. Abrams that
and
I
you
discovered...
didn't know, Mrs. Partridge? I hope I'm dropping down dead if I'm lying. But your man, Mrs. Partridge, your Mr. Billings, he joined the synagogue. Every Friday night I see him sitting there, his hat on his head, a beautiful look on his face, listening. Listening to the voices, and not so much as moving a hand. Of course, it was a strange thing to both Sam and me, but Sam suggested that we say nothing. A man's religion, he said, is a very personal, private matter. We shouldn't even be curious. But that was before he ran into Tim Brady down at the post office.
Ah, it's a wonderful thing it is, Sam. What happened to your Jerry?
What are you talking about, Tim?
He came back to us. He returned to the faith.
Well, he's certainly the most religious fellow I've ever seen.
We'd all but despaired of him, Sam. But to see him there at midnight mass, his eyes on the altar, a look of glory on his face.
I think it must have been a month later when Sam was walking down to his office that he ran into...
Oh, Miss Partridge! Oh, Miss Partridge! Can I see you a minute, sir?
Certainly, Fremont. What is it?
It's about that man of yours. Say, is he crazy?
He's joined your church.
Oh, no, sir. We don't want him. Only we don't know what to do with him. He's been coming down to every Sunday night now. He don't make no noise. He just sits there and listens. Sit there and listen. Sit there and listen.
So curiosity got the better of us. And that evening, while Jerry was hoeing in the garden, Sam went out to talk to him.
Jerry, I don't like to pry into your private affairs, you understand, but...
What is it, Mr. Partridge?
Well, there's something I'd like to know.
Why don't you ask me?
Jerry, how many different churches do you belong to?
Most all of them.
Well, don't you find that they conflict with one another just a little? Their doctrines, their teachings?
Their teachings? Who cares about that stuff? I like the music.
Those are the people we met that first year in Phelps. Those and a few others. Gus Decker, for example, who knows how to watch his pennies.
I always say, Mr. Partridge, that 50 cents is enough to charge anybody for making out his will. Now, if it's a bill of sale for a horse, that's different, and I'm willing to...
And then the little Horton girl. Daisy, her name is, all of 16, who brought me one of my very first cases.
Well, it's about Ed Price, Mr. Partridge. We go steady, you know, and if ever there was a jealous boy, he's one. Now, I wondered if you could advise me how I could go about
Daisy Horton, Miss Jane, who runs the grocery store, Fred Rice, the district attorney... Tommy Mabry, the 10-year-old son of the station.
Tommy Mabry, now 76. Miss Jane, gone for over half a century. Daisy Horton, whose great-grandchildren have built homes across the nation. But that's today. And what you're concerned with, Mr. Attorney, is yesterday. Yesterday as it came from my father's small black record book, the basis for country lawyer.
Thank you, Mr. Bellamy Partridge. And now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury... You millions of American listeners, the CBS court asks a 30-second recess. We then present for your review, Forecast Number 9, with Raymond Massey as the country lawyer.
This then is the Columbia Broadcasting System. The Columbia Network presents the first in the new series based upon the best-selling biography, Country Lawyer. The simple story of a simple American, Samuel Selden Partridge. Country Lawyer, starring the distinguished actor of stage, screen, and radio, Mr. Raymond Massey.
Tonight's episode, ladies and gentlemen, is part of the history of the little town of Phelps, New York. A dramatization of events which occurred a full generation ago. It's an odd tale, this episode. And yet, were you to place it beside the famous remembered chronicles of your own hometown, you'd find it quite at ease. It is, then, a part of that vast catalog of fabulous truth which forms the splendid, enduring pattern of American life. It's true, of course, that it comes from Sam Partridge's small black record book, straight from these faded dog-eared leaves. But it's your story just the same, this case of the Bill of Rights. Page 41, 2, 46, 47, September 10th, 1885, it's dated, and written in my father's neat, precise hand. It begins near the bottom of the page. Night of our first house dance, one of the warmest evenings we'd ever had in Phelps, but only a little warmer than what we'd been having for weeks. No rain and everything so dry
that the sparks from a horseshoe hitting the pavement could start a roaring brush fire before you could say Grover Cleveland. As a matter of fact, there had been quite a number of these fires lately. Ern Skinner's livery stable, for example, had almost gone up the week before. Nevertheless, there wasn't the slightest bit of uneasiness the night of the party, and all of our dozen or so guests seemed to be enjoying themselves. Even J.C. Hellman, who runs the bank and normally has the sourest face in Ontario County, was smiling a little. I can see him now dancing with Emma over near the orchestra.
I'll say this, Mrs. Partridge, you certainly know how to waltz.
Thank you, Mr. Hellman. It's very pleasant to... dance with you, too. You're so light on your feet.
Oh, you really think so? Well, now, you know something, Mrs. Partridge? It's really a shame that you and Sam and me and the missus haven't got together much before.
Yes, isn't it?
Oh, but don't worry. We're going to remedy that.
All right.
Oh, there's Sam and Mrs. Hellman over by the punch bowl. Oh. Shall we join them?
Oh, fine, fine. Exactly what I need.
Well, just in time, you two.
Sam?
Let me pour you some of this punch.
Huh? Thank you, Sam.
I don't care how good it is, just so it's cold.
I'm afraid you're going to be a little disappointed, Mr. Hellman. The ice supply is about gone. I sent Jerry out for some more, but he's late getting back.
Oh, Jerry Billings, is that?
Yes, he's probably got into an argument with somebody.
Honestly, Sam, I don't see how you put up with that fellow of all...
Now, J.C.
That man's the orneriest old cuss in town.
And the best gardener in the state. Well,
yeah.
Here's to you people.
Ah. Fine party, Sam.
Thank you, Mr. Hellman.
Hey, Sam, I was just telling your wife. I think it's time you folks knew some of the right people in town. You know what I mean?
Yes, I think so.
Never heard a young fella just starting out, did it? Especially a young lawyer.
Well, Jerry, glad you finally got here.
Well, that's a good thing, too, or this ice would have melted plumb away. Where's your punch bowl, Mr. Partridge?
Over here.
All right. Stand clear, everybody, and I'll drop her in.
Jerry, be careful.
Watch what you're doing. You splashed it. You're crazy.
Oh, J.C.
Oh, awfully sorry, Mr. Hellman.
Now, listen, J.C., don't get yourself an uproar. That stuff ain't going to hurt your suit or you either.
Over my Sunday trousers.
It's all right, J.C. Everything will be all right. Come on, now. Let you and I have this chat.
Ought to be more careful, Jerry.
Ah, that'll teach that old coot. I raked his leaves up last week. Took me 2 hours. You know what he give me? A nickel.
I know, Jerry, but what's that?
It's the fire call downtown. Let's look into this, Jerry. Oh, and Emma,
yes?
Better not wait up for me.
All right, Sam.
We learned was just back of the Woodpecker Inn, Gus Decker's house. By the time we got there, our two volunteer fire squads had already pulled up in the square beside Old Tick's Hotel. Our water pump, Old Ocean, was ready for action. and the captain of the hook and ladder detail was leading his men
this
up
this way,
to the
men. Grab hold of them handles and start hunting.
Oh, no, you don't, Jeb. We got here first, and we're operating Old Ocean.
All right, man. Now, wait a minute, Jim. You used her last time. Now we get the crack at it.
Our
hunt's as much ours as it is yours.
You get on back to your minstrel shows. This is the time of Christ.
Watch what you say, Jim. You're talking to the captain of the hook and ladder.
And you're talking to the chief of the hose brigade. Now, clear out before I bust you one.
You and who else?
Well, me, for one. Duck your head, chief, and I'll handle this smart aleck.
Don't worry, Captain. We're right behind you. We've been itching to show something with this hose brigade, and now we're going to do it. Up and at him, boys. Come on, show
him. It's Tex.
Hey, you ding-busted crazy fool, Jim. Ain't you got no sense? Oh. What you going to do, keep on fighting while the whole ding-busted town burns up?
Wait a minute.
Stop it. Stop it, you hear? She's already finished Gus Decker's house. She's spreading like the wind.
That's right. Cooling stars on fire. Man the pumps, boys.
You take the right side, Jim. We'll take the left.
All set, Jeff. Let's go. Down.
One.
Two.
Joe Cooley's store was going fast. And then suddenly the thought struck us. Or rather, it struck Jerry first. Right next door over Hanson's drugstore.
That'll go next. Come on, we gotta get your lawful. Huh?
It's already hit the steps, Mr. Partridge. It can't go up there.
Well, you can't either, Jerry. Come back here.
Get off that steps,
Jerry.
Mr. Partridge. They won't hold both of us.
You'll be trapped, Jerry. Come back here.
You just stand there. Axe these books when I throw them down.
Look out, Jerry.
Here they go. Look out, they'll knock your head off. Here comes some more. Watch it.
Look out, Jerry.
Well, Sam, that's that.
Hotel all right, Tick?
Just scorched the south wall a little. How about your office?
Saved most of my books, thanks to Jerry. Two stores and a house. Quite a fire.
Yep. Let me show you something I just found. What you think of this?
Looks like a stick that didn't quite get burned up.
Uh-huh. It's a pine splinter. You'll notice them little shavings whittled into the side. Found that alongside this pop bottle. Here, take a whiff.
Kerosene.
Uh-huh. That's what set fire to Gus Decker's house.
You mean somebody deliberately started this fire?
Kind of looks like it, don't it? Anyway, it's worth investigating. May have a firebug among us.
Firebug?
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 Firebug! There's a firebug around here.
It's arson, that's what it is.
It's a pyromaniac.
Look out, who's that man?
What's he doing
it's
here?
It's a firebug. He don't know who it might
don't
be.
Leave the house.
Don't leave the
store.
Who's that man?
By the next morning, word had spread like the fire of the night before, filling the town with fear, apprehension, suspicion. The report went around that the insurance people had an undercover man in the town, but that didn't seem to bother the firebug, because it was less than a week later that he struck again. Virgil Damron's coal bin burned, and about 36 yards away from the ruins, they found a charred but recognizable pine splinter, cut exactly as the other. The next week, Rox Rogers' cider mill was almost down to the ground before they could wheel Old Ocean out there. That time they found the same kind of pop bottle with the same traces of kerosene. And the next one to get it was J.C. Hellman, president of the bank and our guest at the party a month before he lost his house. And by this time, the town was not only terrorized, it was hot with vengeance. It wanted that firebug. Then a couple of days later, young Mabry, the station master's son, came running into my temporary office.
Mr. Partridge, the district attorney wants to see you right away.
Right away, Tommy? What about?
The firebug. They caught him.
What? Anybody you know?
Sure I know him. So do you. It's Jerry Billings.
Jerry.
Hello, Mr. Partridge.
There he is, Sam. He asked me to send for you, so I did.
Thanks, Fred. This isn't true, is it, Jerry? You didn't do it, did you?
No, sir. They're all wrong about this, Mr. Partridge. They're just trying to find somebody they can blame it on, that's all.
I know, Jerry. Fred, you got the wrong man.
Afraid not. The insurance fellow over there caught him half an hour ago. He was burning some leaves back at the city hall, and he used his regular tools. A bunch of whittled pine splinters.
Well, but I always use
and
them.
And a
that's
pump
what I...
bottle full of kerosene.
Well, I found it. Can't you understand anything?
Look here, Fred. That's not enough evidence.
Not to start with. Take him away.
All right. Can't you talk some sense into these loons, Mr. Partridge?
Oh, come on, Billings.
Don't worry, Jerry. You'll be represented all right.
By who?
By me.
Are you crazy?
Never more serious in my life. I believe in that man, Fred. I know him.
How long have you known him?
Oh, a year or two, ever since we moved here.
We've known him all his life. He's a troublemaker, Sam, and outs with everybody. He fits this charge to a T, and I'm going to send him up.
Not without a fight.
Don't be a fool, Sam. This town's hotter for blood than I've ever seen it. They hate the man who's been burning their homes, and they're not going to love the man who sticks up for him. Now listen, Sam. You're new here. You need all the goodwill you can get, and you can't get it by defending a firebug.
Maybe I can get it by saving an innocent man. One thing's certain, Fred. I'm not going to stand by and see Billings turned into a sacrificial offering. A victim for a lot of people too angry and excited to know what justice is.
Well, I was only trying to save your career. You'll see what I mean when that trial comes up.
On behalf of my client, Your Honor, I object on the
ground. Objection overruled. Proceed, Mr. Prosecutor.
Now, Mr. Hellman, to go back. Where were you on the night of the Gus Decker fire?
Well, I was at the home of Sam Partridge. That fellow over there.
Counsel for the defense, you mean. And was the defendant there?
Not at first.
Was he, for instance, there at 7:30, the time the fire broke out?
No, sir. He was downtown near Decker's house.
Objection! The witness has no way of knowing where the defendant was. He knows very well the defendant went after ice.
And right after he came in, the fire alarm sounded. All I know is he was gone long enough to start off 10 fires.
Your Honor, I object to the way this witness is allowed to say anything he chooses. This is a deliberate attempt.
The conduct of this trial is not the province of the defense, and I warn him to respect the dignity of this court.
Proceed, Fred.
Thank you. Tell me, Mr. Hellman, did you ever notice any antipathy, any ill feeling between the defendant and Gus Decker?
Yes, I did.
On what occasion?
Well, it was just before Gus's house burned. Gus was at my place on a matter of business. Seems he wanted to buy into the
just
West 40
moment,
over near Miles Creek,
moment.
And I...
Just stick to the question, Mr. Hellman.
Oh, yes. Well, anyway, Billings saw him come in, and he yelled up to me and said that if I gave Gus any money, I needed my head examined. Well, naturally, Gus didn't like that, and he called Jerry a tramp.
What did Jerry do?
He called Gus a skunk. Said he'd get even with him.
I see. And have you personally had any difficulties with the defendant, Mr. Hellman?
I object. That question is entirely irrelevant. It has no place
I disagree, Your Honor. Mr. Hellman's own house was destroyed in these fires, and I intend to establish a motive for that occurrence.
Objection overruled. The witness may answer.
Well, yes. Billings has always had it in for me. Now, just recently, for example, he cleaned up my yard. And even though I paid him a dollar for his work...
That's a dirty lie. That old skinflint never paid me more than a nickel.
Jerry, sit down.
Your witness, counselor.
No cross-examination.
No, sir. Jerry's had it in for me for a long time. Long before he burned my... I mean, long before my house burned.
How long, Gus?
Oh, about 20, 25 years now, I guess. It was over a... Well, it was about a girl. We were both going with her, you see, and... Well, Jerry didn't get her, that's all.
And he's held a grudge against you ever since, I see. Now, on the night your house burned, did you happen to see Jerry Billings?
Yes, I did. Just as it was getting dark. He was walking along the alley back of my house.
Thank you, Gus. Cross-examine.
If you please, Gus, about this old romantic rivalry between you and Jerry.
Yes, what about it?
You say Jerry didn't get the girl. Did you get her?
Well, no.
What happened?
Why, that good-for-nothing sneak told her about me and Mabel Spence, and that's the last I ever seen of her.
And yet you continue to respect and admire Jerry
Billings. Admire him? I wouldn't spit in his eye, the rotten, low-down...
In other words, Gus, you're a somewhat biased witness. That's all. Thank you very much.
I don't know why you asked me that, Sam Partridge. Of course I run a grocery store. You trade there most every day.
Well, just a formality, Miss Jane. What I am interested in is this. A while back, were you or were you not advised as to how to produce a quick fire in your store?
Why, yes, I was.
And what was the method suggested?
A few sticks of pine splinters, well saturated in kerosene.
And who suggested that?
Why, that fellow up there, the judge.
Well,
the
This entire testimony, Your Honor, is irrelevant, and I move that it be stricken from the record.
Motion carried.
Members of the jury, spectators, with your permission, I should like to interrupt your keen enjoyment of this trial only long enough to state a few facts. You will, I know, expect me to speak at some length on these properties which the prosecution is pleased to call evidence. That bottle with the telltale kerosene odor, that incriminating splinter of pine. Those properties which are, in reality, no more incriminating than any other articles of the household that are used at some time or another by most all of us. You are prepared to have me impress upon you the frailty of a case built wholly upon curious circumstance. You will expect me to portray my client as the lonely, friendless, embittered, but harmless fellow that he is. That your eyes and ears tell you he is, but your emotions say he is not. These things, however, I shall not discuss. I shall instead remind you of one thing only. That part of the Bill of Rights which gives every man in this country a fair and honest trial. That's a right. That's a privilege. And it's yours to have and to hold and yours to give. Remember, though, that a fair trial doesn't mean an inquisition. It doesn't mean bias, unreasoning hatred, and prejudice. It means a hearing governed by justice. I ask you, gentlemen, have you helped produce such a trial? If in your hearts you know you have not, there is still time. There is still time to cast a vote for decency, sanity, and fairness to a fellow man who is guilty only when he's proved so, and never before.
You have seen the concrete evidence of this man's vile deed. The pine splinter and the kerosene. The insignia, as it were, of his foul, inhuman craft. You have been shown how for years he has absorbed hatred and jealousies until at last they burst forth upon a rampage of destruction. But like my learned opponent, I shall not dwell upon these facts. They are too obvious and too clearly established. I ask you only to gaze upon this defendant and see him for what he is. A lone wolf, a fiend, a dastardly sneak who hold in our gardens by day only that he might burn our houses at night. Yes, gentlemen, when you file into the jury room to cast your fair and honest vote, remember this. If the truth were to appear blazoned in letters of fire on yonder wall, the words would read, nay, they would cry out, this is the man.
There's a jury, Mr. Partridge. They're coming back.
Already?
Yes, Jerry.
Well, what do you think? Do you think that they're...
Hard to say.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you agreed upon a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
How do you find?
We find the defendant guilty as charged.
Guilty?
Clerk will enter the verdict upon the record of the court. I will set Tuesday next as the date upon which sentence will be passed. Court dismissed.
Come on, now. Let's
help. Well, I guess I'll be going down the road, huh?
That's a miscarriage of justice if there ever was one.
You act like you was going instead of me.
There'll be some way out, Jerry. Don't worry.
And don't you worry neither. Here, I guess you've done all you could. I blame sight more than I had called to ask you or anybody else. Well, looks like they're waiting to...
Mr. Partridge, that's the fire gone.
You're right, Jerry, and it's worth finding out about.
She's too far gone.
out!
Stand back, boys. That wall's gonna drop any second.
Whose barn is this, anyway? Anybody know?
Sure, Sam, I know.
Whose is it, Dick?
Mine. I sure never expected old Jerry to pick on me. How'd he get out, anyway?
Get out? He didn't get out, Tick. Gus here and Hellman and I just left him. He's been right there in court for the last 2 days.
That's funny, because I wasn't here more than a couple of minutes before I found this.
A pop bottle.
And these pine splinters.
Well, then, there's another one around.
I don't think so, J.C. Maybe you didn't take a good look at this bottle. It's exactly the same brand as the others. And them splinters cut just the same way. No, sir, boys, we just ain't caught that fella yet.
But that's wrong. We got the firebug. He's been convicted. It's Billings, I know it is.
Don't see how it can be, Gus.
It's a trick, that's what it is. Somebody's trying to fool us.
In what way? How?
By making us think there's another firebug, that's how.
Oh, making us think there's a... Hellman, let me ask you something.
Yes?
When Gus here came to see you about that loan, why didn't you give it to him?
Why, because he wanted too big a loan, and, well, he wanted it right away. I couldn't do it.
What is this, Partridge? What are you getting at?
The money you were after. I think I know what happened. When J.C. turned you down, you decided to get it by collecting the insurance on your house. So you set fire to it, and everything was fine.
You're crazy.
Until the insurance man learned about the pine splinters and kerosene and started investigating. You knew then you had to keep him away from you.
What are you saying, Partridge?
Suddenly, Gus, you heard people yelling firebug, and that was your answer. You set fire to those other houses. You made it appear as though the arsonist had simply started on your house and gone on from there.
Hey, boys, come here and listen to this.
There ain't a word of truth in that, Partridge, and you know it.
Oh, yes, Gus. You're our firebug. You burned your own house and all the others.
That's a lie. I couldn't have burned my own place. I wasn't there. I wasn't anywhere near there.
You weren't? That's strange. You testified in court that you were. You said you saw Jerry Billings out in back, remember?
That
was so you could put as much blame as possible on him, wasn't it?
Wait a minute. Maybe I did fire up my own place. But you've got no right to accuse me of all the others. Let me show you. Listen, I've been with you and J.C. over in court, ain't I?
That's right.
Well, then I couldn't have burned Tick's barn, could I? Don't you see there's a real firebug round here? He's the one you want, not me.
I don't know, Gus. It wasn't worth much anyhow. Besides, I don't think I'll get into any trouble for burning down my own barn. Wasn't carrying any insurance. Chief, why don't you and your boys give Gus a lift up to the sheriff's office?
Fine idea, Tick. Come on, Gus. We'll let you ride on old Ocean.
You've got no right to do this. This ain't no court of law. I'll sue the whole...
Well, Tick, we were just lucky to catch Gus. Even if we hadn't, though, your bogus fire burned a hole right through that circumstantial evidence. Jerry can thank you for being free.
Shucks, I knew he was innocent right along, Sam. Jerry never could start a fire worth a cent.
I guess that's as good a reason for sticking up for him as they had for knocking him down. You know something, Dick? I think Phelps will learn something from Jerry's trial. I think that by morning she'll see how dangerously close she came to committing one of the greatest violations a people can commit. The denial of one of man's inalienable rights. A trial by an impartial jury. We set up this country, you know, in order to ensure those rights, in order to establish justice and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Those objectives are the framework of our democracy, and once we shake any one of those foundations, we weaken the whole of the structure. We're a young country yet. Maybe it'll take us another generation or so, a few more scrapes with intolerance before we really have that lesson down pat. Maybe it'll take something far more grim than this small hearing in a country courtroom. Maybe it'll take the kind of trial where a whole nation is sentenced without cause and executed without mercy. I hope it doesn't take that. I hope such a thing never occurs. But as sure as you're standing there, Tick, one day we'll know that lesson for keeps and we'll thank heaven for the precious things we own. Freedom. Tolerance. The guarantee of...
What's the matter, Sam?
What a time to be saying all this.
Can you think of a better time?
Yes. Back there in the courtroom. Who knows, Tick? Might have saved your barn.
Ladies and gentlemen, CBS has just presented the first in its new series based upon the best-selling biography, Country Lawyer. The story of an average working man of a generation ago and his influence upon his own community. The portrait of America in the making.
Yes, America, that was quite a case, Jerry. Almost as narrow a squeak for Mrs. Partridge and me as it was for you.
For all I know is it was sure a long time before I even had nerve enough to light my pipe. I guess that was about the first case you had in Phelps, weren't it?
First hard one, anyway.
But not the first big one. Oh, not that yours wasn't more important, Jerry. But there was one that was quite a bit larger. That was the time Sam defended heaven.
Yeah? Who was suing?
J.C. Hellman, naturally.
Someday I'll tell you about it, Jerry, when there's more time. But you probably remember parts of it anyway. The time we had the really bad drought, with the crops withering in the field and nearly all the wells gone dry. Everyone was so desperate, in fact, that they were willing to try anything. Even the plan of our Presbyterian minister. He wanted every person, good and bad, to get down on his knees at 12 o'clock noon and join in a great town-wide prayer for rain. And nearly everyone agreed. They got the time signal from the whistle over at the grass seeder factory, and the one from the tin shop, and the one from our other factory, the flowers. And then people actually got down on their knees and prayed.
We come on all the knees,
they prayed for 5 long minutes, and then they got up. They didn't say anything. They didn't even look at one another. And they didn't move too rapidly. But they did walk over to their windows and open doorways and gaze hopefully up at the sky. It was glaring bright, with the fiercest sun they'd ever seen. But by 1 o'clock, a few small clouds appeared. By 2, a gusty breeze began to blow. By 3, a tiny drop was felt, and in another minute, rain. Rain in torrents, a full-bodied cloudburst with all the trimming, great peals of thunder, and one never-to-be-forgotten flash of lightning.
Good morning, J.C. Fine rain, wasn't it?
Fine, huh? Just take a look at this.
What is it?
It's my claim against the Presbyterian Church for $2,000. That lightning struck my silo.
Yes, sir. J.C. Hellman sued the church for having produced the rain. The blessed rain that had brought relief to the town and destruction to J.C.'s silo. Representing the church in the matter, I had J.C. on the witness stand.
Do I believe in prayer? Well, yes, Sam, of course I do.
And you yourself actually pray?
Well, on certain occasions, yes.
Then why, when you saw your silo going up in flames, didn't you pray that it'd be saved?
Well, that's ridiculous.
Not at all. You said you believed in prayer, didn't you?
Not every prayer.
Oh, just the ones for rain.
No, of course not. Anybody knows
that. Then what reason have you to believe that this particular prayer for rain was answered?
It was different, that's why. This wasn't any ordinary kind of prayer. That church got practically everybody in town to go in on it.
And that, in your mind, made it nearly 5,000 times more effective. See? All right, J.C. Let's assume that this prayer for rain was unequivocally answered. Now, tell me this. Did the people pray for anything other than rain?
Oh, that's all. Just the rain.
In other words, they did not ask for lightning.
No, they did. Now, look here, Sam.
That's all, J.C. Your Honor, we maintain that the people of Phelps asked God only for rain and that the lightning was strictly his own idea.
But Sam, Anna, that isn't fair, and you know...
All right. Case dismissed. Court adjourned.
I remember that case, Mr. Partridge. But weren't there quite a lot more to it than that?
Yes, Jerry, but it would take at least a half an hour to fill in all the details.
You know, Sam, I've never been able to understand why you don't keep some kind of a record of these cases.
Oh, I'm not an author, am I? I'm a lawyer.
Yeah, but you're a father, too, ain't you? And how you know your kids won't want to know something about you? I call to mind one case right now. Little Daisy Horton. You remember that time she stopped on the street?
Mr. Partridge, I just want to tell you how nice you were to speak to Ed for me.
Well, I hope it did some good, Daisy.
He said you'd made him see the light. He's not jealous of Brad Tompkins anymore.
Glad to hear it. I'm glad.
No, it's worse. He's jealous of you.
Daisy, I couldn't have been too bad at Cupid. Let's see. How many do you and Ed have now?
8, but that's enough for us. We only want a small family. But don't you see, Mr. Partridge, what happened after I saw you that day? The whole funny mix-up and all would make a wonderful story. And there's so many more. Well, like that trouble over Miss Jane. That time when she was so ill, when she had you draw up the will that would leave what little she'd made in her store to Tommy Mayberry.
Her nephew.
Uh-huh.
To pay for his book learning, she put it.
And you remember her brothers, Spence and Orrin, and how they didn't want there to be any will because then they'd get the estate.
And blow it all in one fine spree. Of course, I remember, Daisy. Let's see, you were acting as Miss Jane's nurse and were there at the bed with Spence and Tommy when I brought the will over.
No sense in your bothering Jane now. She's too sick.
No, she isn't, Mr. Partridge. Not if you hurry.
You have a pen ready, Daisy.
Oh, no. No, you don't. Jane can't sign anything, and you know it. I ain't going to stand for this.
New pen, Daisy.
By a bed. Tommy, will you let Mr. Partridge sit there?
Sure, Daisy.
Miss Jane. Miss Jane. Can you hear me?
What? Oh, yes. Who is it?
Sam Partridge, Miss Jane. Can you sit up just a little?
Oh, yes.
Here, let me help you.
You can see she can't make it. Let her alone.
Spence, you get out of here. Sam, paper. You have the paper?
It's right here, Miss Jane.
Oh, no, you're no good. You try and force her, you'll kill her, and I'll swear to...
Shut up, Spence. Miss Jane.
Oh. Please, Mr. Partridge, can't you wait?
She'd never forgive me, Tommy. Now, here, Miss Jane, here's the pen.
Yes, I...
It's in your hand now.
Yes, I see it.
Sign your name right here.
Yes, I can't hold it.
All right, now. I'll help to guide your hand now. M-A-Y-S.
Tommy. Mr. Partridge, she's...
That's fine, Miss Jane. Now. B... You are...
Look. Look. She ain't breathing.
Why? There we are.
She's gone. She was gone before that signature was done.
Well, Daisy, I'll be getting back to the office now.
I'll take you to the door.
Look here, Partridge. Jane never wrote a name on that will. You did it, and you're not going to get away with...
Mr. Partridge, there won't be any trouble, will there?
Trouble? Why, you didn't see anything wrong, did you, Daisy? And you're certainly a more reliable witness than Spence.
Mr. Partridge, I want to thank you for what you've just done and, well, for so many other things that I know about. Good things. Things that have helped.
Oh, now, wait a minute. There's something I'd better tell you now so you won't be disappointed later. You're talking as though I were the Archangel Gabriel. Well, don't do it, Daisy. I'm too busy earning a living to try to be, even if I wanted to. No, Daisy... I'm merely a lawyer instead of a doctor or a banker or a feed store owner. Sometimes a pretty fair one. Sometimes so woefully inadequate it's painful. Trouble with you, Daisy, you're confusing me with my trade. Because that trade happens to be a great one. It deals in one of the most valuable pieces of merchandise on earth. Justice. Well, come see us, Daisy.
And now, may I call to the stand Mr. Samuel Selden... Excuse me, sir. I mean Mr. Raymond Massey.
Thank you, Counselor. It would be pleasant, ladies and gentlemen, to think that the sample half-hour play you heard tonight brought to life a period you enjoyed meeting. And that goes for the few incidents we just presented. As you must know, they're more than incidents. They're whole stories, really, that are made to order for more half-hour plays. They're merely a few of the countless dozens to be found buried... like so much treasure, in the biography of Country Lawyer. I wish now to thank those who have helped to make this show possible. Charles Vander, who produced and directed, Harold Metford, who wrote the script, and Wilbur Hatch, who composed and conducted the music score. I wish to thank Paramount Pictures for granting permission for the radio adaptation, and also in a more personal way for a very pleasant association in their Cecil B. DeMille production, Reap the Wild Wind. And so... until the very near future, when we meet again, we'll declare a recess. Good night.
Court adjourned.
If you have enjoyed this sample broadcast of Country Lawyer and would like to follow the career of Sam Partridge in weekly episodes starring Mr. Massey, we shall be grateful for a letter or card from you expressing that wish. Send it to your CBS station, if you will. Among those who appeared in support of Mr. Massey were Knox Manning as Bellamy Partridge, Arthur Q. Bryan as Old Tick, Joseph Kearns as the narrating lawyer, Frank Graham as Jerry Billings. Kathleen Fitz appeared as Mrs. Partridge, Earl Ross was Fred, the district attorney, Benny Rubin played the part of Charlie Hobson, and Edgar Barrier the part of Gus. Others in the cast were Barry Kroger, Ed Max, Grace Lenard, B. Benaderet, and Jerry Hausner. Next Monday, same time, CBS will present two more forecast shows for your approval. Forecast number 10 from New York. An all-star cast in an unusual new program called Three Wishes. If Aladdin's lamp and its magic powers were available to the most interesting personalities of our day, what entertainment would they wish for? For next Monday's forecast, illustrating this idea, CBS has asked Alexander Wolcott to name his three wishes. The very bill of fare ordered by Mr. Wolcott requires the services of such famous stage celebrities as Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine, America's foremost acting couple in one of their rare radio appearances, of such noted wits as Moss Hart and Russell Krauss, of such famed playwrights as Maxwell Anderson and George S. Kaufman, together with music, all tendered to Mr. Wolcott and the listening guests by Carl Van Doren, who will be master of ceremonies and gratifier of wishes. Forecast number 11 from Hollywood, Tony Martin, singing star of radio and pictures, versus Bert Lahr, the cowardly lion of comedy, in a new mixture of music and merriment, tentatively titled Search for a Sponsor. Linda Ware and Dave Rose and his orchestra will aid and abet Messrs. Martin and Lahr in their search. Until next Monday, then, at forecast time, this is Arthur Gilmore saying goodnight. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.